Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Tuesday, December 1st, 2015. Chicago fires its top cop. Because it's burning my numbers. 1, 2, 3. It's as easy to learn as your ABC. Burning my numbers. 1, 2, 3. It's as easy to learn. More than 1,000 Americans have been killed by police officers this year alone. And just before Thanksgiving, a court forced the Chicago Police Department to end its cover-up and release the video that showed the grisly execution of a young man named Laquan McDonald, age 17. Now, he was running down the street. The cops said he had a knife, but he wasn't near enough to anyone to threaten them. Yet, we're told police officer Jason Van Dyke had to empty 16 bullets into the body of this young man in order to protect himself. That was the cover-up. And the cover-up failed. It was proven to be a stack of lies by the video that the court courageously ordered released. And so it's time for some damage control. And Chicago's maximum mayor, Rahm Emanuel, has fired the top police officer. He carries the title of superintendent, and the job has been held since 2011 by Gary McCarthy. And it's interesting because I believe he's being fired because the cover-up failed. As you may know, I learned a lot from the streets of Chicago. I went to Northwestern University. I started my radio career there in the 1970s. And the cops were quite corrupt. I've shared the story of how I bought marijuana from an on-duty police officer who delivered it to the radio station in a squad car while he was on duty and in uniform. He never got caught, because the blue wall protects most wrongdoing by police officers in Chicago. So it's the failed cover-up. Not any sense that we're going to clean up the mess in the Chicago PD. Their motto, like so many others, is to serve and protect, and we always thought that the protection part was what they cared about the most in terms of shakedowns. But Rahm Emanuel may not be able to end the damage right here, because there are other scandals that we've talked about. The Guardian newspaper, all the way from Britain, has done a great job where the Tribune and the Sun-Times failed in exposing the detention center at Holman Square on the west side of Chicago. And Mayor Emanuel has not held Gary McCarthy or anyone else to account for the unconstitutional and barbaric treatment of individuals who were held there. Their rights were clearly violated, but because most of them were black, and Holman Square is still in use, well, you know, the same rules don't apply. Now, to try to show the veneer of action to clean up the mess, Emanuel has named a 5-person commission to conduct a top-to-bottom review of the department, and former governor of Massachusetts, Deval Patrick, he's also former chief of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, he will be some sort of an advisor to that commission. Will the commission investigate Holman Square? Oh, I doubt it, but I'd love to be wrong about that. Meanwhile, the Cook County Sheriff, Chicago's in Cook County, Illinois, Tom Dart, has been brushed back by the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and the brutal pen of Judge Richard Posner. And the history is, and Glenn Greenwald recounts this in an article today at The Intercept, that previously Sheriff Dart had tried to shut down the adult ads, the sex ads, on Craigslist. And he was overruled in that effort. So he decided to try to shut down another adult ad online classified service called Backpage. And Backpage does include ads by prostitutes. That's what he was trying to clean up. So instead of using his legal authority, what he did was go to the credit card companies, to Visa and MasterCard, and say, cut these people off. I don't like what they're doing. But as Posner wrote in his judgment, if he had done this in his capacity as a private citizen, he'd be within his rights. But he's using the power of his office to threaten legal sanctions against the credit card companies for facilitating future speech, and by doing so is violating the First Amendment. And Greenwald properly connects this to the case against WikiLeaks, where former Senator Joe Lieberman, who was running the Senate Homeland Security Committee, threatened Visa, MasterCard, Bank of America, and PayPal to end the credit card processing for WikiLeaks. Now, WikiLeaks has never been shown to have violated the law. There are no court judgments against WikiLeaks. And so Joe Lieberman just used the power that he held as a senator and a committee chair to intimidate these bankers into doing his bidding. And it's pretty much the same kind of pressure that was used to shut down the community group Acorn a few years back when they were victimized by phony video predators, a guy named James O'Keefe. And a quote from Greenwald, he says, as I wrote at the time of the WikiLeaks blockade, any attempt by political officials to start blocking Americans' access to political content on the Internet ought to provoke serious uproar and unrest. Because, no matter what you think of WikiLeaks, they've never been charged with, let alone convicted of any crime. Lieberman literally wants to dictate unilaterally what can and cannot be read on the Internet to prevent Americans from accessing documents that much of the rest of the world is freely reading. Now, Cook County is not the only scene of corruption and nefarious power grabs by elected officials and those in uniform. The Guardian, in its continuing series on deaths by police officers in this country, and by the way, the total as of December 1st is 1,040 Americans who have been killed by police officers this year alone. And they single out Kern County in Southern California. That is the site of Bakersfield. That's the county seat and the biggest city there. And on a per capita basis, Bakersfield is the most dangerous city in America. And this county is it has the dubious distinction of per capita having killed more people than any other American county in the country. And just to give you a point of reference, there are five counties that comprise New York City, and 13 people have been killed in the single Kern County, California, which has a population of under a million, and only 9 people were killed by the NYPD across those five counties in New York, with 10 times as many people and 23 times as many cops. And the Guardian story focuses on the death of a young man named James De La Rosa. He was 22 years old. He was stopped by cops. He exited his car, threw up his hands, kept them outstretched, and he appeared to be saying, "What's up?" or "I'm here, come arrest me." But the officers claimed that he was reaching for his waistband. And then they shot him, and they killed him. And the Guardian story also singles out one police officer, whose name is Rick Wimbish. He is a department veteran, and he trains other officers in the use of firearms. And Wimbish, who makes almost $200,000 a year in pay and benefits, has used deadly force 4 times, 4 fatal shootings in 2 years, including the case of De La Rosa. And a review by The Guardian identified 54 fatal shootings over the last 10 years in Bakersfield and Kern County. At least 49 of those 54 were publicly ruled justified by panels of senior officers from the same department as the officers involved. And you know you can trust them, right? So this just shows that law enforcement is way out of control, deeply off the rails in this country. And in my view, as I've stated before, it all comes back to providing accountability and protecting whistleblowing officers who are willing to tell the truth about wrongdoing by their colleagues. We will never clean this up if we don't address the no-snitch rule among uniformed police officers. A new study from George Washington University, which I, as you're about to hear, have some problems with, reports that 56 Americans were arrested on charges related to the Islamic State during this calendar year so far. And what is interesting, buried in the article, this is from the New York Times, by the way, is a notation that the number of people flirting with ISIS, being investigated for online sympathetic commentary about jihad or the Islamic State or Daesh, the number of reports has dropped. But the thrust of the article and the headlines is to inject fear. That there are sleeper cells and lone wolves who watch videos, who may be prepared to act at any time. So here are some of the statistics from the report ISIS in America, from retweets to Raqqa. And we understand that the arrests in the last 18 months, 80% were younger than 30, 40% were under 21, 14% were women, 40% of those were converts to Islam. About half of them tried to travel abroad. But what's very interesting to me is that the article that I'm looking at is comprised of 21 paragraphs. And close to the end, in paragraph 15, it reads like this. More than half of those charged were arrested in an operation involving an informant or an undercover agent. And this, of course, is what raises deep concerns in my mind. And I want to recommend that you, if you have an HBO subscription, that you watch a powerful documentary called The Nuremberg Four. The film does an excellent job of explaining how these four men who attended a mosque in Nuremberg outside New York City were befriended by a paid FBI informant named Shahid Hussein, I believe. And he provided them with all of the means, the ideas for an act of jihad. And then he gave them a Stinger missile. And these guys had no idea what to do with it. Are they going to shoot down a plane? It was just bizarre. But possession of a Stinger missile under federal law has a 25-year minimum mandatory sentence. So these four guys who basically were trying to pick up $250,000 in cash that the paid informant was dangling in front of them did what he asked them to do. He framed them. Then he testified against them in court. And it's those cases that undermine the credibility of the FBI. And let me acknowledge that there are real cases of people who are sympathetic to ISIS, people who watched an Alaki video and decide they want to blow something up. But from everything I can tell, they are a very small percentage of the total cases claimed by the FBI and this kind of report, embraced uncritically by the New York Times, will just propel this misinformation, disinformation, into the general public. And it's one of the issues that I discussed in a wide-ranging conversation today that I'm releasing to subscribers with Scott Shane. Scott is a reporter for the New York Times. He's got a very important new book that just came out called Objective Troy, and it's about the American drone program, the targeted killing program, and specifically the targeted assassination of the American Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen in 2011. In this excerpt from my conversation with Scott Shane, he talks about the layers of secrecy, the phony nature that things that are declared secret are widely known to Americans and people across the world, and that the Congress and the courts have ducked their responsibility to provide some accountability for the expanded use of drone strikes by President Obama.
Well, you would think that even if you're going to enshrine a procedure like this, you would want it to be subject to certain rules. And everything has remained, as you say, in secrecy. What's sort of odd is that Awlaki was killed in 2011, and Obama announced it that day, but in this kind of peculiar way, you know, that Anwar al-Awlaki is dead mm-hmm. in Yemen, and congratulations to the brave men and women of the intelligence community, but never quite said how he happened to die on that day. And then in 2013, he actually gave a speech in which he took responsibility for it and talked in somewhat greater depth about it. But it seems rather haphazard and casual as to, you know, what becomes public when. Something you said made a lot of sense to me, because I have sort of noticed the rise of a class of information since 9/11 that you might call public but classified. Mm-hmm. And drones would be the ultimate example. Obviously, if a missile comes from the sky and kills somebody in Pakistan or in Yemen, it's not secret in any meaningful sense of that term. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that this just happened, and everybody pretty much knows now who did it. You know, so what remains secret? What remains secret is, on what basis was that done? What was the intelligence that led to that strike? You know, who carried it out and why? And what is the accountability in terms of, you know, if it happens you killed the wrong person, if you hit the house full of civilians next door to the Al-Qaeda headquarters, you know, who holds anyone accountable for that? Who goes back and even makes sure the process, if it's going to go on, you know, is improved? When things are done in the dark by anyone, and certainly by government, it's a recipe for, you know, incompetence and waste and disaster.
You can hear the full interview with New York Times reporter Scott Shane about his new book about the Awlaki killing. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, at iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, all of the places where you find my podcasts. And every day I pause to thank people who support my work here with your subscriptions to the podcast. And once again, Faith People's name pops up because she's got so many subscriptions and is so generous. Also, Bob Donjakur, Nick Gaksich, and Linda Lewis. They are all subscribers, and I'd like you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click the menu link in the upper right corner, and that gives you choices like become a subscriber. You click on that, and the next page you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, the $50 annual subscription. We've got our new app for iPhones and iPads available at the Apple App Store. I'm working to bring you news about a solution for Android users to catch the podcast very conveniently. We should have that information for you in a day or two. So I would appreciate you coming on over and providing the support I need to keep the podcast going. One of the most powerful images I've seen in the last 24 hours came from Paris, where, as you know, protests were banned around the climate change conference. And despite that ban, I don't know how they managed to do it, but hundreds of people, and perhaps thousands, brought their shoes to a public plaza in Paris. And since they were not allowed to personally occupy their shoes in protest or in support of the climate change conference, they just left the shoes there. Maybe you've seen the image on Facebook, or a friend has shared it with you. But it's a very powerful expression of people who have been silenced. And it touched me in a kind of interesting way. Yesterday I mentioned that President Obama has hinted that he might commute the sentences of all or most of the 62 people who have been convicted and sentenced to death in the federal system. And that one of those people is Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, the 22-year-old who has basically at trial conceded that he and his brother detonated those bombs at the finish line of the Boston Marathon in April of 2013. As you know, I have many problems with the way he was tried. I won't rehash that for you today. If you're curious and you haven't heard, just enter the search window at peterbcollins.com, Tsarnaev, and pull up some of the interviews I've done with Russ Baker and other people related to the Boston Marathon trial. At any rate, Tsarnaev's lawyers have filed an appeal calling for a new trial, and based on a recent Supreme Court ruling, the dismissal of 15, fully half of the 30 counts that led to conviction of Dzhokhar Tsarnaev. Now, this is based on a June Supreme Court ruling that said that the legal definition of a so-called crime of violence is vague, unconstitutionally vague. And I've commented before that Tsarnaev was overcharged. 30 counts is just, you know, really throwing the book at him. And if half of those are dismissed, then his legal team would be well within their rights to demand a new trial or, at minimum, a new sentencing phase for Dzhokhar Tsarnaev. Jason Leopold over at Vice News has been sifting through the latest batch of emails released from Hillary Clinton's private server. And as you know, I'm often critical of the former Secretary of State. I don't support her candidacy for president. And it might shock you that I have something nice to say about Hillary the Hawk. Because it appears this hawk has a heart. In an exchange released by Leopold at Vice News yesterday, Secretary Clinton praises Harold Koh, K-O-H, one of her legal advisors at the State Department, for his handling of negotiations with the Canadian government over the release of the former teenage prisoner at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, Omar Khadr. And we have covered Khadr's case in some detail in previous podcasts as well. And so it actually warms my heart to see that Hillary Clinton, despite a general pattern of not getting involved in individual cases of Guantanamo inmates, took a special interest in this young man's plight and worked to negotiate his release to Canada. And you can read the email exchange for yourself. I will link to Leopold's article in the show file for this podcast. But I think that it is an interesting dimension and something that I didn't know about. I'm happy to share with you. While we're talking about young people and the law, in Jerusalem on Monday, two Jewish teenagers were found guilty of murder by an Israeli court. They're responsible for the kidnapping and killing of a 16-year-old Palestinian, Mohammed Abu Qader. He was taken into their custody. They brutally beat him. And then they poured gasoline on him and burned him to death in a forest in July of 2014. And this was part of the episodes that occurred. You remember there were three Israeli teenagers who were kidnapped, and the Netanyahu government knew that they were dead, but pretended to search for them for 18 days while they rounded up hundreds of Palestinians without any real connection to the case. And it became part of the pretext for the 51-day assault on Gaza in the summer of 2014. So I'm pleasantly surprised that the Israeli justice system worked at least to the point of convicting two of the three men responsible. The third is an adult named Yosef Ben David, age 31. And at the very end of the case, right before the verdict, his lawyers submitted a last-minute psychiatric evaluation raising doubt about his competence for the actions that he is accused of. And I can't evaluate whether that is appropriate or not. But the father of the young boy who was brutalized and burned to death, Hussein Abu Qader, attended the court hearings. He said that he had expected that Ben David would plead insanity and that he fears that he'll be treated with leniency. Quote, "This makes a joke of the court," and he said, "my blood is boiling." President Obama has stepped in the middle between Turkey and Russia over Turkey's shoot-down of a Russian fighter jet last week. At the sidelines of the Paris Climate Summit, Obama spoke to the media after a meeting with the Turkish President Erdogan. Obama said the U.S. supports Turkey's right to defend itself and its airspace. And this is really stupid of Obama to step in the middle of this. As you know, at most, the claim is that a Russian jet violated Turkish airspace for 17 seconds while it was flying at over 800 miles an hour. Nevertheless, the war of words has escalated as Vladimir Putin has said that Turkey shot down the jet in order to protect supplies of oil being smuggled in from the Islamic State territories in Syria. And as a result, Erdogan has said that if Putin can prove that those claims are true, that he will resign. Now, this is a very interesting high-stakes threat. And listen to Erdogan's very carefully stated denial here. "We are not that dishonest as to buy oil from terrorists." I mean, that's quite an admission. We're dishonest, but we're not that dishonest. And he went on to say, "As soon as such a claim is proved, the nobility of our nation requires me to do this. I will not remain in this post." But then, in a double dare to Vlad, he says, "But I'm asking Mr. Putin, would you remain?" Well, Russia has moved quickly to impose economic sanctions on Turkey. They announced that they will ban imports of agricultural products, vegetables, and fruits. And within a few hours, more than 1,200 trucks carrying Turkish exports were blocked from entering Russia. So that's moving very quickly. And meanwhile, Turkey, having negotiated a deal with the European Union that includes a relaxation of Germany's objection to Turkey becoming a member of the EU, the EU is going to pay over $3 billion to Turkey to help fund refugee camps and relief efforts. And in exchange, Turkey appears to have agreed to try to stop the flow of refugees and migrants toward Europe. So on Monday, Turkey rounded up 1,300 refugees, 750 detained in a pre-dawn sweep, and another 550 who were found hiding in olive groves. These were people who were poised to cross over to the Greek island of Lesbos. So it's a murky situation, and it kind of brings to mind that Ben Carson, the Republican candidate for president, trying to burnish his foreign policy credentials, took a trip to Jordan over this past weekend, where he says he talked to refugees who are just real happy to be there, and that they want to stay there. They don't want to come to the United States. And I hear this a lot. Sean Hannity keeps promoting the idea that to prevent terrorists from, you know, coming in with refugees to the United States, we need to seal our borders and then just give them money to create, he doesn't call them concentration camps, but that's what I will use, and try to hold them there until the hostilities are over. But Syria has been virtually destroyed by 5 years of war. And the recent bombing by the U.S. and by Russia and by Turkey makes it even more a pile of rubble. And so to imagine that people are going to hang out in refugee camps for a couple of years, hoping that the war will end and that they can go back home, well, I think that's pretty crazy. Today, a law goes into effect in Michigan, written by the National Rifle Association, that will widen the prospect of individuals getting concealed carry licenses for pistols. Now, up until now, they had a system of local gun boards that could reject an applicant based on various criteria. But the law basically says if you don't have a history of mental illness that is known to the state police, and that's a critical factor, known to the state police, then a county must issue you a concealed carry permit. This will not end well. And the idea that good guys with guns can be at a stadium or at a school or at a church and turn around and prevent a mass shooting by killing a perpetrator is Hollywood fantasy. But that's how this is proceeding. Since 2001, 441,000 applicants have obtained a concealed carry license in Michigan. There are now 500,000 people who are packing. Oh, And Michigan lawmakers are considering another bill that would allow the concealed weapons holders to bring guns into areas designated currently as no-carry zones, including schools, bars, stadiums, and churches. A little good news for Lori Berenson. Scratch your head, Lori Berenson? Lori Berenson. Well, she has been imprisoned in Peru for 20 years. Actually, the last 2 years, she's been on a kind of house arrest situation, completing her parole. But she was convicted of treason in the nation of Peru in 1996 for alleged involvement with the Tupac Amaru militant group. And she did later issue an apology, which was seen as a way to obtain parole. She had a child while she was in prison. You can do that in Peru. And she is coming home to live with her parents in New York State. Puerto Rico is in deep, deep trouble. Its governor, Alejandro Garcia Padilla, told the United States Senate that they are out of cash and can no longer pay or pay down $72 billion in debts. They did manage to make a $350 million payment to creditors today, but that's all they've got. And as you know, federal law prohibits Puerto Rico, as a commonwealth or a possession, not a state, from using the bankruptcy laws. And I think that's the only way out here, and Congress hopefully will relent. But in the meantime, the island of Puerto Rico, where more than half the people live in poverty, is in deep financial trouble. You may have heard that the Koch brothers support criminal sentencing reform. I was surprised by that, pleasantly. But now we see what their true agenda is, because a bill that that was passed out of the House Judiciary Committee last week would basically provide immunity for corporate CEOs accused of criminal behavior. It's called the Criminal Code Improvement Act, and it says that if a federal law, a criminal law, does not explicitly state what the mens rea is, and mens rea means mindset, did somebody know that it was a crime before they did it? Well, unless that is specifically stated in the statute, then the state of mind the government must prove is knowing. So they have to show that a CEO knew that they were selling tainted chickens or peanut butter or something like that. And this is a hurdle that will make it very difficult to pursue those prosecutions in the future. And finally today, kudos to the American Medical Association. Their House of Delegates recently voted for a ban on direct-to-consumer advertising of prescription drugs and medical devices. And I don't know about you, but the dick stiffeners and many of these other pharmaceuticals that are advertised on TV, where, to the credit of the government, these advertisements are required to include the side effects, including, you know, your left arm may fall off or you might just die. Well, that doesn't dissuade people from putting these commercials on TV. And it certainly generates demand by consumers who go to their doctors and say, hey, I want to try that new drug I saw on the TV. Well, I fully support this. And if you do, go to change.org. Because they have a petition called Pull All Drug Ads from TV. And yesterday when I checked, they had 38,000 signers, probably far more by now. I hope you will join in this effort, and maybe we can get the drug ads off television. Hey, thanks for listening to my news and comment podcast. Will you please share this far and wide? Put it up on Facebook. Click the like button. Share it. You know what to do. Thanks.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.